About food waste are pretty well everywhere these days, and yet despite individual and local and regional efforts to counter waste of all sorts, the piles of rot and trash keep growing. Do we need to go visit a municipal landfill to really get it? Do we need to lobby our politicians better? Do we need to make more smoothies and soups? Or are humans just wasteful by nature? Welcome to Digesting Food Studies, the podcast that tries to make the most out of every vegetable peel, dented can, and scraping of peanut butter while still tempting your earbuds with the savory sauce that is Food Studies. I'm your home economist, David Santo. This episode focuses on the systemic, layered, messy, and oh-so-challenging subject of food waste, slipping back in time to an 1861 publication on household management, and looking forward to critical discourses on waste management hierarchies. And as long-term prospects for planetary resources look ever scarier, much of what we talk about here might also extend to the spaces beyond food and food system, if such spaces even exist, of course. The article in focus this episode is Tamara Soma's Critical Food Guidance for Tackling Food Waste in Canada. It comes from Volume 9, Issue 1 of Canadian Food Studies, published in April 2022. We start off this episode, as usual, with Alexia Moyer's Amuse-Bouche segment, focusing on a historic cookbook that is heavy with intentionality and social structuring. It also reveals much about the morality and responsibility associated with being frugal. I then talk with Tamara Soma about why food waste is so complex, yet often made to seem simple, and also how food waste solution planners might look to closed-loop food systems for some answers. Then, in response, PhD student Dante Gejewo builds thought and action bridges among the notions of food waste, agricultural transformation, and indigenous ways of knowing. So, Alexia, I tried to think of a good waste joke, but I just simply couldn't come up with one. But so instead of joking about waste, let's be serious about it. Tell me, what have you got for our amuse-bouche today?
I have a very serious cookbook for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's called, in its full title, The Canadian Housewife's Manual of Cookery, carefully compiled from the best English, French, and American works, especially adapted to this country.
Okay, well, that is a very non-wasteful title. They are very economic with all of their words. Not.
19th century titles are always incredibly long. It was published in 1861 mm-hmm. in Hamilton, Ontario, by Henry Richards and published by William Gillespie. And I want to focus on the title because it gives us, first of all, a clue into the state of publishing in Canada in the 19th century, which had this common practice of compiling writings from existing texts from neighboring countries and cultures while seeking to adapt to a Canadian context. So what is specifically Canadian is not overtly articulated in the prefatory materials, but there is attention to ingredients, which can be readily found by Canadian cooks.
So yeah, what is Canadian? The giant question that lurks on all of our lips. Go on.
The question I'm wondering about is who is the intended audience of this book? And it's very clearly laid out in the beginning. The quote, female mistress of the family. And the epigraph at the top of the page states, those deserve the greatest praise who best acquit themselves of the duties which their station requires.
Ooh, that sounds both empowering and disempowering at the same time.
Exactly. So what are the duties of the female mistress of the family in 1861? Here's a helpful list as laid out to us. To attend to the nursing and at least early instruction of children and rear a healthy progeny in the ways of piety and usefulness. To preside over the family and regulate the income allotted to its maintenance. To make home the sweet refuge of a husband fatigued by intercourse with a jarring world.
Oh, those jarring worlds. Sorry.
Note my emphasis. To be his enlightened companion and the chosen friend of his heart. Interestingly, for 1861, it places female management on par with male earnings potential.
Mm, that's the compliment, right? If you bring in money, you also want to make sure you're economic with it. So that's a partnership.
Yeah, so it states many families are indebted to their prosperity full as much to the propriety of female management as to the knowledge and activity of the father. But these tasks, and I think this is the important part, are discrete. So they're separate and they're to be maintained. Key to this epigraph and to the book as a whole is this idea of station, of keeping to one's rank as assigned by gender and class. To be stationary is best.
So like so many publications, whether they're coming from a church or a government or some sort of social ordering system, it's really about, it's about control.
Absolutely. Yes. So what is the point of this book? It's partly about recipes, mm-hmm. and it's partly about helping readers to reduce food waste, or more broadly speaking, reduce household waste, which is not just food. It's about managing all the resources of a household, whether that is time and ultimately money. And there are tips and tricks throughout, from where and how to store dry goods to prevent insect infestations, how to wash knives properly, just the blade and not the wooden handle so that you don't wear it out.
Wow.
Yeah, there are various understandings of waste and wasteful habits and behavior. One is tidiness. It is recommended that everything be kept in its proper place. Not just a matter of aesthetics here. It's really the purpose is to save time looking for an item.
It sort of echoes of like the 1950s ergonomic studies, like reducing number of steps within a kitchen.
Yes, yes. Another positive attribute in the household is the ability and wherewithal to keep household items in good repair. So to make proper use of your tools, like you don't use a vegetable peeler to shave your legs.
Well, I do. Why not?
Could you imagine the carnage? Okay, so I added that last part in there. Another good habit is keeping to a schedule. So planning out the work of the day early with one's domestic servants. I always give orders early to my servants so that they have the time to do the work. It's really about being well organized.
Well, it's fairness. You need them up at 4:30 in the morning so that you can give the hour long description of what to do. I basically stand in front of the mirror for an hour every day and tell myself what to do.
You and I don't have paid staff, but many Canadians did at this time. Domestic service was a major source of employment and not just reserved for the upper classes. Knowing how to properly carve meat is another thing. And it's really not just about appearances. It's really knowing how to cut the meat as close to the bone as possible so that you reduce the waste, and then using the bones to do other things like making stocks and broths.
And what I'm getting from this whole description, and maybe this is a clue as to the author's intention, is, you know, in colonial history, if they were using this place as a land from which to extract resources, having the people living here and extracting them, you wouldn't want them to be using up too many of those resources or wasting the resources that had been extracted in order to, you know, benefit the colonizer's home country. Mm-hmm. So there's this very colonial undercurrent to this, or maybe overcurrent, which is weird because today when we talk about being mindful of waste, and, you know, indeed there's an enormous discussion about how much food is wasted in all sorts of different parts of the food production web. It's not about saving the colony or saving the colonizer. It's about saving the planet more broadly. It's about not over extracting from the places where we draw our resources and not using up, well, fossil fuels particularly. Maybe that is still colonial. I don't know.
Yeah, it's clear that in some ways the narrative around household waste has changed. And some things have remained the same. One of the questions is why would this book from 1861 matter to us? Mm-hmm. It's partly because some of the language kind of carries over into this contemporary Canadian context. So food waste occurs at several points within the food cycle: post-harvest processing, distribution, retail, in the food service industry, and also at the household level. And an article by Carly Fraser and Kate Parizeau, also published by Canadian Food Studies, looks at the fact that approximately half of food waste occurs in households. Now, the measurement of that household waste, I still have to do a little bit of digging on that. But where Parizeau's and Fraser's article really speaks to me is the fact that they highlight that food waste management has been constructed to fall along gendered lines.
Yes.
So in other words, overwhelmingly, waste management has been regarded as women's work, both in 1861 and still today.
Something that our friend Pamela Tedge explored in her own PhD work. So yeah, this has given us a lot to think about, chew on, get ready to digest. I'm looking forward to our conversation with Tamara Soma up next. I think this has provided a very lovely amuse-bouche to the subject. Thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Samara Soma is an associate professor at the School of Resource and Environmental Management at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. Her research brings together food systems planning, indigenous food sovereignty, food loss and waste, food systems resiliency, and circular food economies. Samara serves science and society in numerous ways, including with the Global Institute for Agritech and the World Wildlife Fund of Canada, among other organizations. Well, first of all, Samara, thank you so much for joining me on Digesting Food Studies and talking to me about food waste. I'm really excited to have you here.
So excited to be here too, David.
2022 is when this article came out in Canadian Food Studies. And yet the subject of food waste has been floating around for quite a good amount of time in food studies. And it's getting ever more pertinent as things keep changing in our very complex food systems. But tell me sort of overall what this article is about and why you particularly study food waste and why it's such an important issue right now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, being the critical food studies scholar that I am, I was very perturbed and concerned around some of the suggested solutions, like the simplistic solutions when it comes to food waste reduction, food waste guidance, and, you know, often the conflation of, you know, there's a lot of food waste in here, there's a lot of hungry people there. So if we just combine it together, everything will be a win-win solution. And so when I wrote this paper, it was part of a larger project. So it's a special issue with Professor Jennifer Sumner. And I basically try to unpack some of the dominant solutions when it comes to food waste, particularly as it relates to the food recovery hierarchy, which I can talk a bit about more. There's like basically different levels of hierarchy on what you should do, what priorities when it comes to reducing food waste.
Well, and your point that solutions are often way too simple when it comes to any problem within our food systems. Certainly the problem of food waste is not simple in any way. So simplistic solutions are very problematic. And as you said, this is all part of a larger issue on different kinds of food advice, food wisdom, ways of understanding our food systems in more complex ways and how humans, eaters, consumers, and all sorts of people who operate in food systems can think more critically and certainly in more complex terms than the given knowledge that is often proposed in the sort of popular media around things. Because of course, food waste, we as eaters all know that there are things we can do to reduce it in our own homes. And that tends to be where a lot of advice is focused. But it's obviously a much more complex problem than just what we throw in our compost and what we don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, although I published this paper back in 2022, actually just last year, during Halloween time, I received a phone call, a message from a journalist from the United States asking me for my feedback, my comment on this particular solution that was promoted by a corporation to basically reutilize, upcycle Halloween candies to feed it for livestock.
Whoa.
And you know, the whole idea again behind this is that there's a lot of Halloween candies around. It's getting wasted. There's a lot of livestock around. So like Halloween candies, livestock, you know, combine them together, win-win solution. And you know, I was thinking like, oh my goodness, let me send you this paper.
Well, it's yet another way that corn is just being transformed into more and more things that nobody actually wants to eat, including our animals. But whoa. Okay, that's a whole new take. You mentioned the hierarchy of wastes. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I know that's a central point of what you're critiquing in the article.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically what people would often see and what they would kind of recognize is this image of an upside down pyramid, upside down triangle. And it's basically a diagram that was adapted from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency food recovery hierarchy. And so at the very top level of the hierarchy, which is what you should do first before you do all of the other things, is reduction at source. So it's basically prevention, which is great, but probably one of the least talked about or really discuss solution when it comes to addressing food waste. Then feeding hungry people, that's kind of like the second level of the solution. Feeding scrap to animals, that's the third one. Industrial purposes, like for example, anaerobic digestion and you know other ways to manage industrial waste. Composting is kind of like almost at the very bottom. And then landfilling, it's kind of like the least desirable and the last solution. Like, you know, if you have to do it, you know, that's what you're going to do. So that's kind of like the diagram.
Yeah. And so it's a pyramid, like the old food pyramid. It's easy to understand. It communicates quickly and simply, but it also leaves a lot of questions out, right? The simplicity actually kind of dumbs things down.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you know, when we think about this pyramid, you know, and this is where the critical piece comes in and what this paper talks about is we don't often talk about the issue of scale. And at the end of the day, also, you know, it leaves very little room to question the industrial food system. Because again, like if you think about the Halloween candy example, well, technically I'm like, that's great because that's the third level of the priority, which is feeding scraps to animals. And so like, you've done a great thing. Go pat yourself in the back. And so what I wanted to do with this paper is really kind of like unpack, and really think about how we can address the root causes of food waste rather than just put a bunch of band-aid stopgap solutions.
Yeah, because food waste is not just, I mean, there are many places that food waste happens. The consumer food waste is not just about that. Waste at the site of production, I know, is a major issue. Sometimes it's an issue of fruits and vegetables, for example, not looking pretty enough to go into the mainstream industrial food chains. And so they don't get harvested or they don't make it into the retail environment. There's waste produced in transformation. There's waste produced all along the food web or all throughout the food web. And that's where it gets super complicated and very invisible for most day-to-day eaters to see, right? I mean, as scholars, we sort of can perceive this through our research, but as regular eaters, consumers, even the producers themselves do not get to see all the steps along the food web. So it's hard for us to both perceive the larger systemic problems and then respond to them. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. Especially for me working as a food system planner, a lot, even for planners that are semi-aware of the issues in the food system, often when we think about the food system, we're kind of like actually talking about the food supply chain. And it's a very linear food supply chain. And what we often don't get to see as planners, as eaters, just as the general public, you know, generally, is the ability to actually visualize and practice and be embedded in circular food system, which means, you know, from seed to growing to harvest, to actually like composting and then doing the cycle all over again, integrated livestock, you know, which is where like I have chickens in the backyard. And so I get to see that circular process every single day, but often people don't have that. It's almost like a privilege to be able to have that. And so, you know, the first front line for our food consumption is usually the retailers. And with the retailers, you don't have the backstory. You don't see that whole entire system and cycle. And because of that, there's this concept called distancing. And with distancing, there's kind of like this psychological disconnect in addition to the spatial distancing, which then results in people actually wasting more and just kind of like psychologically kind of tapping out because they don't really fully understand and aren't connected to the whole value, you know, system of the animals, the labor, and all of that embedded connection within the food that they're eating.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and circularity, and you know, you see diagrams of circular systems in research articles or in newspaper magazine articles, and it seems sort of simple. It says, oh, that makes sense. The outputs of one part of the process become the inputs of another part of the process. And that maintains, that reduces waste, that maintains energy within the system. It sounds good, but it's also really hard to enact as an individual. And so that's part of where the sort of distancing becomes an issue for people not taking action or acting in ways that continue the problematic parts of the cycle rather than the positive potential of the cycle.
Yeah. And I think if you think about how neighborhoods are planned and how cities are designed, the kind of conventional North American dominant way is actually to completely silo and separate things, right? Like when you think about what planners do, you kind of like want to separate the industrial farms from residential, but that's because it's industrial farming. Whereas if you're not doing the industrial farming, it is possible for humans to live side by side with small scale agroecological biodiverse practices. Actually, it's a great thing. You know, you'll have lots of butterflies. You'll have lots of food around you, but that's not how we're living. And because of that, suddenly you're having things like, okay, we have a lot of coffee ground. Now, coffee ground is amazing for gardening, for the soil, but now it's at a scale where it's very hard to manage. And so therefore, you can't just like, you know, put it in the community garden next to you because at the scale is such, you know, you actually have to get a private hauler to pick it up, right? And then deal with that industrial scale coffee ground in an industrial way. So this is where I'm trying to unpack solutions, even things like feeding hungry people. Feeding hungry people with what? You know, when we think about what supermarkets or retailers are wasting, it's not just healthy food, but it's also Doritos and like, you know, Oreos and all of these other
Halloween
candy. So, you know, yeah, we kind of need to look deeper underneath the rug or the carpet or what have you.
Yeah. I feel like over the last 10 years, the discourse around food waste has appropriately gotten more complex. And we started out with sort of facts and figures. It was like, okay, somewhere between 30 and 50% of all food is wasted, and it gets wasted at multiple different sites. But it was really much, very much about numbers and the idea that if you were wasting 50% of the food, then that 50% could go to feed, as you've said, hungry people somewhere else, you know, sort of in an abstract, distant reality that we don't have much contact with as the individual. But over time, it feels like the conversation, the discourse, the academic research in particular, has gone in multiple new directions that go beyond mere facts and figures and start to really deal with what's always going on in food, is that it's systemic. It's a system of systems. And so what do you see as sort of the next step, either in your own research on food and waste or in the larger conversation that we need to not just keep having, but draw solutions out of?
So in the article, I highlight, especially because this article covers a social innovation lab that my team, like the Food Systems Lab team, we worked on while we were in Toronto. We really wanted to center Indigenous voices. This is because I think that we are kind of operating our food system within a particular type of worldview and economic system, which is an industrial approach, neoliberalism, capitalism. And what I wanted to do with this paper is also show that there are different worldviews, different ways of seeing things, different ways of relating. That means that this is not what you do to food, to people, to animals, to the land, because everything is so commoditized within that environmental protection agency kind of food recovery hierarchy. You're never going to get to the root cause. And so the paper tries to do is also to introduce the readers to different ways of engaging with food that makes it so that they're not just eaters, but they're also kind of like food citizens in a way that they have accountability, that they have responsibility, and that they understand that whatever they do to food, it will kind of return back to them because we are all connected.
Yeah. Yeah. So once again, a relational approach rather than the corporate capitalist exploitative extractive approach, surprise, surprise, is probably a better way of getting to our solutions. This has been a wonderful conversation. I would love to go deeper into it. But what I will do is, in fact, invite our listeners to look at some of the other articles that you've written, as well as the other articles on food waste and on relationality more broadly as a longer term, broader set of solutions to a lot of our problems. But I thank you so much for sharing your insights, for keeping it very clear and helping people understand how to think and do in different ways that we're not used to because we're also formed within this contemporary era of food. Thank you so much, Tamara.
Thank you so much, David. And thank you to the Canadian Food Studies team. It's a pleasure.
Dante Gejewo is a PhD candidate in environmental studies at Queen's University and a member of the Kingston Food Policy Council. His research examines on-farm conservation activities such as seed saving, as well as agricultural transformation in southeastern Ontario more broadly. With previous degrees in sustainable agriculture and soil science, Dante is focused on the reality that systems problems always require systemic solutions.
Hello, my name is Dante, a third-year PhD candidate in the School of Environmental Studies at Queen's University. My PhD thesis examines the role that seed saving and on-farm agrobiodiversity conservation may play towards agroecological transformation in southeastern Ontario. Simply put, my research tries to examine how we can change how we grow our food by changing what type of food we grow. So essentially, the main themes in my research are seed saving, on-farm conservation, or more popularly known as in situ conservation, agroecological transformation, or agroecological transition. I read the paper. I really enjoyed the paper. The closed loop food system diagram from the Social Innovation Project was really, really enlightening. For my seed saving research, I have seen bits and pieces about how Indigenous people conceptualize their food system, especially as it relates to food waste. So I was really, really interested in the idea of resilient and just economies, especially as it's tied to the environment. You know, from my research, I've seen and I appreciated how the need or the idea of small-scale growers who are more likely to practice agroecology tied to this idea of fair labor and reduced waste. The idea of reconciliation was also very important, because it is important to understand that, you know, very little can be done without acknowledging the role that colonization has played in shaping the food system that we are in. You know, the legacies of dispossession that necessitated industrial agriculture and the subsequent commodification of food needs. These are concepts and things that needs to be understood. And in my research, I've seen how even farmers that are trying to practice agroecology, you know, to create a more sustainable food system, they don't really understand the role that colonization plays in quote-unquote sustainable food system. So you know, this also ties into the idea of education and how we can use food literacy to create a more wholesome relationship with food. And I've seen how agroecological farmers are trying to redefine what food means to them and the value they ascribe to the food and larger food system they are embedded in. So I really, really enjoyed reading the paper. For other readers, anyone that is reading the paper for the first time, I would strongly suggest spending some time with the closed loop food system diagram and seeing what parts of the diagram you can apply to your research and in the context of the broader food system. For example, for my research, it was related to just and resilient economies and the environment and the need for more agroecological ways of producing food with using decentralized small-scale producers. So I would advise anyone to see how they can use that diagram and relate it to their research, and also not to be pigeonholed to a particular area of the diagram, but see how different parts of it can complement their work, especially when thinking about the broader food system we are all embedded in.
I often rail at people on the street who dump their used beer cans in my composting bin or their compostable takeout dishes still loaded with leftovers into my recycling. And the other day I saw an empty soft drink bottle sitting on the candy rack at a drugstore checkout where someone had clearly just left it. The drive to get rid of one's waste, like right now, is apparently very strong, and it overrides common sense and general social cooperation. Is it about urgently needing to separate ourselves from the abject? Or is it simple laziness? A lack of caring and concern and awareness? Or the all too common belief that people always think it's just someone else's problem? Whatever the motivation, waste is clearly everyone's problem, even though some of us experience the effects and damages of waste much more than others. And I'm not talking about me and my recycling bins. Thank you very much to this episode's attentive and conscientious guests, Alexia Moyer, Tamara Soma, and Dante Gijewo. Our scrupulous and sensible executive producers are Rachel Engler-Stringer, Laurence Godin, Charles Levko, Phil Loring, and Kristen Lowett. I'm the podcast's inventory manager, David Santo. Check out the show notes for additional links and details about our guests, and don't forget to like, comment, and rate the show so that more folks can come to this digestion party. Or just tell 10 friends to come and listen to the show. If you tell them nicely, they'll be sure to trust your good judgment, won't they? Adages like waste not, want not, or a stitch in time saves nine seem kind of anachronistic these days. Not so much in terms of what they're actually communicating, but more in the sense that they just sound lesson-y or didactic, but also judgmental. In the current era of extreme self-expression and the often over-valorization of individuality, those formerly unifying and common-sense expressions can seem trite. But is it really so problematic to have common values about thriftiness, economy, and care? Do we need to self-express through a laissez-faire attitude or a lack of worry about resource sharing? Oh well, it's not like one bad apple spoils the barrel, and we certainly don't all have to cry over spilled milk. Or maybe we do.